Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is Tony Gilkison, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcasts.
Pantheon Podcasts presents from Hollywood, California, The Devil's Music with Pleasant Gaiman. You are invited to join the Hollywood princess as she explores her lifelong pursuits in the occult, sex, love, and that sinful rock and roll. Ladies and gentlemen, step into the dark parlor of Pleasant Gaiman as she brings you the Devil's Music.
Hi, I'm Pleasant Gaiman, and welcome to the Devil's Music, a Pantheon podcast. As the devil himself apparently once said via the Rolling Stones, please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a rock and roll witch from Hollywood, California. My obsession with music and the occult started at the age of 12 and is still going strong. During the 70s, I was one of the first punks in Los Angeles. I worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go and had a Xerox fanzine called Lobotomy, which led me to writing a rock and roll gossip column in the LA Weekly, which in turn led me to writing for every major rock publication you could think of. In the 80s through the 90s, I fronted three bands. I'm a best-selling author with 8 books out and more on the way. For the past 30 years, I've been a professional dancer who's toured around the globe teaching and performing, and you've probably seen me dancing in a number of music videos, feature films, and documentaries. I'm also an actor with several film credits. Find out more about me at PleasantGaiman.com. I'm really excited to be a part of the Pantheon Podcast Network of rock and roll shows. Everyone at Pantheon tells spectacular stories about the music we love so much, each one with a different twist. Find them all at PantheonPodcast.com, as well as on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, radio.com, Pandora, hell, I just had to say that, anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. If you like what we're doing here, head on over to pantheonpodcast.com and share a show with a friend, or I'll put a spell on you. Kidding.
Hey, this is Pleasant Gaiman, and you're listening to the Devil's Music Podcast. Today, I'm so glad to have my guest, Javier Escovedo, on. He's a pioneer of punk rock. When he was a teenager, he started the Zeros in 1976, and by 1977, they had an album out. An all-around amazing musician. He's also the founder of The True Believers, and he's had a couple of solo albums out too. We've been friends for, I don't even know how many years. I'm senile, so I can't really count them, but we were both teenagers when we met in 1977. So anyway, without further ado, here's the amazing Javier Escovedo. Hi, dude. How the fuck are you?
Pretty good. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, my God. You're so welcome. I don't even remember the last time we saw each other. I mean, I don't know if it's been decades or just a few years. I honestly don't remember.
Do you? I know. It's all a blur.
Yeah, no shit. But I do remember the very first time that we met. And I mean, that incident for me, you know, of meeting you guys was amazing to see the zeros in action. But also on the gig where we met, it was just incredible. It became one of the like defining moments of LA punk rock. And it was at the Orpheum Theater. And yeah. I think it was the 15th of April. Was it April 15th?
I'm not sure, actually.
You know what? I think so, because the Damned played at the Starwood on the 16th and the 17th.
That's right.
Yeah. And
they were in the audience.
What? Yeah, they were in the audience. But first, okay, so me, along with all, like everybody who was in the LA punk scene, wound up going to Bomb Records, which wound up being your label, not, you know, just a few months later. But we went to Bomb Records to see an in-store appearance with the Damned, and everybody in the entire punk scene was there. I went with Kid Congo and the Germs. I mean, there was like Helen Keller was there. Everyone that lived at the Canterbury was there. All the girls that were just about to, you know, just starting the Go-Go's were there. This was like the event of the century in LA punk rock.
Yeah.
And the Germs had just barely formed. I think they'd had one rehearsal. And we met the Weirdos there at Bomb Records. And, you know, they said that they were playing at this little theater called the Orpheum that night, which the Nerves had rented out. And it was right, it was sort of catty corner from Tower Records on Sunset Strip on this little back alley street called Nellis. And it was a tiny little like black box theater, which I think was like, I don't know if it was 50 or 99 seats. I think it was 50. It was really tiny. But
yeah,
somehow,
it was small.
Somehow I convinced I told the Weirdos that the Germs should open for them. And they were kind of panicking, the Germs were. But the Weirdos said yes. So then we went back to my house. And how do you prepare for a gig? You stop at a liquor store and get Chris Ashford, who later, you know, wound up like managing the Germs, because he was legal. We got him to buy a bunch of like pink cold duck, you know, because only the best stuff for us, and a lot of licorice whips, which Bobby Pinn, who later turned into Darby Crash, got. And then as soon as we got back to my house, we all started taking Quaaludes and drinking the cold duck.
Oh my God!
I know, and this was that was probably about 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And then, you know, the ride up to the Sunset Strip was a blur. And I was still like wrapping Bobby Pinn, AKA Darby Crash, up in the licorice whips in the back seat. And it was all hot. It was a really humid day. And that shit was melting all over the place. And we were laying there and everyone was like out of their fucking minds. Like, you know.
Oh my God.
Yeah, anyway, so.
Well, that gives me a great background of what
of why the, it was so
the Germs
crazy.
Were the way they were that day and that night. That's hilarious.
You know, like, even if they would have had like, even if they only would have had one rehearsal, they wouldn't have been like that the way they are. I mean, we were so fucking gone before we even got there. But
that's great.
Yeah, and then I think that they got kicked off stage their very first gig because Bobby Darby got peanut butter out, and that started the whole Germs like food craze that I don't even know how it started, but I'm blaming it on the licorice whips and the cold duck and the Quaaludes. Anyway,
yeah,
when they got nicely escorted off stage, then you guys came on.
Yeah, that was our first show. That was our first show in LA. We had only played two shows before that, and they were both in Rosarito, Baja California.
Oh, wow. I didn't know. I think I just assumed they were in Chula Vista, where that's where you live in, right? So what was
we're all living in National City and Chula Vista, a suburb of San Diego.
Yeah, it's like right there near the kind of near the border crossing, right?
Totally by the border.
Yeah.
And well, we gave I saw Backdoor Man magazine, and I saw that they reviewed some demos, and so I wanted to get a cassette to Fast Freddy to see if he would review it in Backdoor Man. And so we recorded some stuff, and I gave it to a friend who gave it to a friend who gave it to Fast Freddy. It was Jackie Ramirez and Evie Bebo. But so they got it to Fast Freddy, and he gave it to Paul Collins. And Paul Collins called me and said, we want you to play the show in LA. And it was totally just like wild, you know, because we're in San Diego, we're in Chula Vista. And all of a sudden, like, we have a gig in LA. So it was really, really exciting for us.
Well, I mean, like, I don't know if you realized it at the time, but everybody from the LA punk scene who was there was absolutely just blown away by you guys. I mean, like seriously, like we were all staring in astonishment because, I mean, you seemed so tight to us. When I say seemed so tight, I honestly that didn't even matter at that point in time in punk rock, because we were used to, like, you know, like how you said, you'd only done two other gigs, but a lot of the bands in LA at that point had only done one other gig. Like, I remember the Go-Go's first gig, they played three songs and two of them were the same song. You know what I mean?
I love that. The Zeros did that at a party in San Francisco once. We played like Chatterbox like five times.
But I particularly was so I was so taken with you guys because I was 17 then, and I don't know, were you guys like around 14 or 15 or am I like not remembering?
Bobo was 16 and Robert was 17 and Hector was 17 and I was probably 18 and then I turned 19.
Oh, wow. Year. You guys looked, this is exactly like what I kind of wrote in my diary, that you guys looked like a really young mixture of, some kind of, band that would be not a boy band, but like in those days, like some kind of band like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, where you had a really uniform look and just like your songs were so fucking amazing. Like I still all the time, even before you called me like or emailed me like a little while ago, I would just get like Don't Push Me Around or something, just Beat Your Heart Out, you know, like stuck in my head for hours, like and not in a bad way, you know, not like when you get like Ooga Choco, yeah. Ooga Ooga or some lame song.
That's funny.
But you just seemed
well,
to
thank
me like
you.
Yeah, it seemed like you just sprung like fully formed into an amazing band that had like a total personality and look and incredible music, you know? And I think a bunch of other people thought that too.
Yeah, it was actually like our second band. Before that, you know, we had a song called Main Street Brat, but I moved from Huntington Beach to Rosarito and then back to Chula Vista. And I went to high school. I was supposed to go into like 10th grade, and my parents took me out of school. I was doing really badly and taking a lot of drugs and stuff. And so we moved to Mexico, and I was just on the beach And then they would leave me there all the time. And so I started writing songs, and I was just reading Cream magazine, you know, Lester Bangs, and you know, hearing about the glitter rock scene with Iggy. And I loved the Neanderthals. Yeah. So I got all these influences, you know, and I just loved all of punk rock. Well, it wasn't called that then. So, you know, so then I formed the Main Street Brats when I moved to Chula Vista with one other guy. He was the drummer. So me and him started the Main Street Brats, and we could never find anybody to play with. Nobody would play that kind of music. So when I met Rhoda, my wife, I met her at school, and she said her brother played guitar. So I said, you know, bring him over, you know. So then Robert, you know, she brought Robert over, Robert Lopez, Elvez. And so then the three of us started playing together. So the Zeros was actually kind of like our second band. I mean, we only played like two shows, but, you know, so we had a little bit under our belt.
Yeah, but I mean, it really was like a stunning thing, though. I mean, for real, like
wow, that's least, cool.
And I remember all of us girls talking about it, but not like in a Tiger Beat kind of way, but not in a you know, not in a like we're 18 and they're like younger than us cougar punk rock kind of way.
All of 18.
No, I know. I mean, most of us were like under 18, and that's why we couldn't get into like regular gigs up here unless it was like at the Whiskey or the Roxy or the Starwood, where they actually had food. You know what I mean?
Like, oh yeah, that's right.
So when something like the Orpheum came along, you know, it was great because anyone could go there because it was a kind of totally legal gig. What did you think when you saw the Damned in the audience? Because the Screamers brought the Damned. You knew who they were, right?
Yeah, I knew who they were, but I don't know. I was just kind of, I was really consumed with what I was doing, you know, more than like if I was nervous about them or anything like that. I was just, you know, I was really in my own head about what I was doing through that period, really. And so I was just, I mean, you know, when I heard about like Kim Fowley and The Quick, like before punk rock, you know, I thought, oh, I should be in LA and I should have a band or I should, you know, and all this stuff like that. So like I was more like excited that Greg Shaw was there, basically. Than yeah. The Dam, you know, and so we met Greg Shaw afterwards, and he came and talked to me, and he's like, "You guys should have records out," and that's what blew my mind. You know,
wow, that happened at that gig. I didn't know that.
At that gig, he told me that, and I went home and I said, "We got to go back in the studio," and so I got us back in the studio really quickly, and I recorded a tape, and I drove up to Bomp. And I said, you know, check this out. And he goes, okay, I want to put it out.
Just as it is, right?
Yeah. And it was just like, boom, it just happened within, I don't know, a month. You know, it's just crazy. It was just wild back then how fast everything moved.
I know, like, you know, like now when there's social media and everything moves so fast, some things back then, even when it was just all analog and landlines and shit, just happened so quickly. I mean, all yeah. of it just happened really quickly. The only thing that like wasn't fast, I think, was like waiting for the import English magazines and papers that were actually writing about good music as opposed to what most of American magazines except for Cream were yeah. writing about, because like all kind of punk was so ignored in the mainstream in those days.
Yeah, I know. It was kind of a shame, but yeah.
Unless you were vomiting on the Bill Grundy show or something. No. But so I gotta ask you, about your family, because your family has a bunch of famous musicians in it too, like your niece or your cousin is Sheila E.
Yeah, she's my niece, Sheila.
Wow, yeah. So she was amazing. And for you guys that may not know this, but you know, like we just have to. She was like sort of a Prince prodigy, amazing person, and really great stage presence, incredible like percussion skills and singer and stuff. And then your older brothers, right? Pete and Coke.
Yeah.
They were in Santana, and weren't they in like another band or two together?
They recorded with Malo. So they're like on Suavecito, and they played with Santana and like toured the world with Santana. Then they formed their own band called Azteca, and they signed to Columbia.
Azteca.
Yeah, and they put out 3 records on Columbia. And it was really cool for me, like, you know, I was really young. Like, you know, when punk rock happened, you know, it was great and it was really exciting and everything. But I had already been like backstage at the San Diego Sports Arena watching my brothers play. And so I had a little bit of like not so nervousness, kind of. I don't know. But I went to go see them play like all the time, and it was just amazing. And I got to meet a lot of cool people like Sly Stone and like Boss Skaggs and, you know, Jorge Santana, just like, and Carlos Santana, who was amazing when I met him, actually. I think the Zeros had played like a matinee show at the Mass, and Rhoda and I went to see Santana at the Shrine Auditorium. So I was backstage with my brother Pete, and Sheila was there, but she wasn't playing yet. And so we're hanging out, and Pete goes, I want to introduce you to Carlos, you know? So I said, okay, cool. And this is right when he was starting his like spiritual meditation phase, you know, and he was dressed all in white. He made that record with Mahavishnu, which is amazing. But anyway, so I went to meet him, you know, and I go, hey, you know, Pete goes, hey, this is my brother. He plays in a punk rock band, you know. So I didn't know what to expect, you know. So Carlos Santana, he tells me, he goes, punk rock. He goes, yeah. He goes, yeah, Bill Graham sent me the Sex Pistols record.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I was just like, whoa, what is he going to say, you know? And he goes, I listened to it once. And I go, whoa, what is this, you know? He goes, I listened to it again. And I was like, what is this? He goes, I listened to it again. And I go, he goes, yeah, it's kind of like the early Who.
Wow, and that's true.
And I was just like, you know, so cool for him to not just dismiss it, you know, and just say, oh, you know, whatever, they can't play or whatever. That he listened to it 3 times, and then he realized where they were coming from. I thought that was so bitching when he said that.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I mean,
yeah.
Especially because I do remember when he was in that spiritual Mahavishnu orchestra kind of phase. But, you know, like Black Magic Woman and all of those songs still sound so perfect, you know?
Totally. You made some great records.
Yeah, for sure. So was other people in your family besides like people that were around your old age, like was it like a long line of musicians, or was this just like some familial explosion that just all happened at once with like everyone?
Well, my father was married twice, so Pete and Coke have a different mother than I do. And then so my older brother Alejandro played guitar, and you know, so I started playing guitar probably around 14 or so, you know, and I found out that I could kind of do it pretty quickly, and so you know, I just took off with it, you know. And my brother Alejandro was in a band called The Nuns, you know, eventually.
Yeah. The Nuns from San Francisco. Let's take a little break and then we'll talk about that again.
Okay.
We're going to listen to some Zeros right now.
Okay.
Back with Javier Escovedo, and that was the Zeros, who I still have earworms of all the time. So we were talking about Alejandro and the Nuns. The Nuns were an incredible band, and like they're sort of culty in punk rock because a lot of people don't really know who they are, but the ones that do are obsessed with them.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of bands back then thought, you know, because they saw the English bands get like the big contracts.
Yeah.
A lot of American bands wouldn't sign with smaller labels because they thought, you know, next week, you know, Warner Brothers is going to come knocking, you know. But it wasn't that way. I don't know why it was different in America. But so they didn't make a record, which I consider their best period was when my brother was with them. You know, they made records after that, but it was really cool because, you know, he would come down and he would tell me about going to see Iggy at the Whiskey and seeing the Dolls at the Whiskey and stuff like that. And I was totally into that music anyway, but it was cool because he was giving me like firsthand information. And I wanted to go to those shows really bad, but I was too young. But I did get to see David Bowie and Spiders from Mars at Long Beach Arena. Did you go to that?
Yeah, I went to that, and I got a seatbelt ticket on the way there.
Wow, that's funny. Breaking, I mean, the law.
Probably should have been a DUI, but I don't do that anymore. But
So I got to see the Dolls in San Diego, and that was life changing.
They played
a place called JJ's. It was just a small rock and roll club. I told David Johansen I saw them in San Diego, and he goes, "Oh, you mean at that swabby joint?"
Swabby. Surely. You know,
Yeah, totally. San Diego's all about the Navy. So anyway, so I got to see those two bands, and that they both changed my life, you know.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I don't think a lot of people nowadays realize the humongous connection between punk and glitter, and also between like punk and metal. And when I say metal, I'm not talking about Motley Crue, who was definitely you know, influenced by the whole punk rock scene, because they and Van Halen was too, which people don't know. Van Halen, like David Lee Roth, used to go to all the gigs at the Whiskey, like constantly.
I know. I saw him there all the time.
Yeah. And that, and then also playing with the early days of Van Halen, they used to play with like the Motels and the Quick constantly. That was like, that was like a regular bill that happened a lot. And sometimes like the Quick would open and sometimes the Motels would open, because in those days they didn't have like the exact genres that they do now. You know what I mean? It was just anything that was later going to be called like alternative. Like they didn't care if one was like more metal sounding or one sounded more pop. It just like, it was music that wasn't the mainstream norm of like Captain and Tennille or whatever garbage was on the radio.
Yeah, but, I know. I kind of miss that.
No, I know. I miss it too a lot, but I just, and when you look at those early punk rock pictures of like all of us, like some people look like punk, but not like what later punk, what people came to know as hardcore. They just looked crazy. Some people look sort of Rocky Horror Show-ish, but not trying to copy it. A lot of people, like a lot of girls, look like 20s and 30s vamps, or like someone you'd find in, you know, True Detective, like caught up in
flappers
in a shopping bag or something. Yeah, like, you know, like 50s pinups or flappers. I mean,
yeah, it was cool the way it was. Because, I mean, that first 2 years, you know, like anything went almost, you know, and it was really exciting because not all the bands sounded the same. They didn't all play the same instruments. You know, the Screamers had two keyboards, you know, that was just amazing. You know, it was really cool. And like the Weirdos, you know, they were, we all had guitars and drums, but they were totally different. You know, there was a lot of difference between the bands that I think was missing later on.
I agree. Yeah. And I mean, the bands were like, everyone was so exciting and individualistic. And to me, it was clear that like each band had their own like full on like vision and sort of persona, as well as the instrumentation and the songs. And that was, I mean, that was really cool too. That was one of the things that struck me about you guys. Like I said, you know, it seemed like a fully formed package. And a lot of the early punk bands were like that. And I often wonder if it's because I was so young and excited by everything, you know, or if it really was true. And like, don't you, when you look back, it seems so weird that all of that early scene was like in about a 2.5 year span, because it was just so amazing.
I think it's because that there wasn't a lot to go on. You know what I mean? There wasn't a lot to copy yet, you know, that you had to make it up yourself in a way. You know, you couldn't be Bowie, you know what I mean? You couldn't be Iggy. Well, some people tried, but you know what I mean? You know, and so it came from all these different places, the Velvet Underground, the Dolls, you know, like, and so everybody took on little aspects of each thing and amplified them. And so it was exciting. It was different.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once, new quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, like going back to the nuns, like Jennifer Miro was so incredible, you know?
Yeah, I know.
She was like a 30s chanteuse meets like a post-apocalyptic like cult leader or something.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they were amazing. And it was funny because one time we were going to go see the nuns, and Trudy said, "Oh, I love the nuns. They're so professional." It was really funny. Well, they had like really good equipment. They had managers. They had roadies. You know, none of the other bands had any of that stuff.
Yeah, I know. No one had that. Yeah, they also had. They had really good. I remember their flyers looked really kind of polished too.
Yeah, they had management and stuff.
Yeah, none of everyone else had that. Like, except for like The Quick and The Runaways with Kim Fowley. I think it was Kim Fowley's birthday yesterday or today.
Was it?
Yeah. So, when you guys are hearing this, you'll know what day or date it was recorded on.
Right on.
Who were some of your favorites from? The early punk scene, like either in San Diego or in Mexico or in LA or anywhere, like people that you were playing with?
Well, probably my favorite was the Dills.
Yeah.
And I got to become friends with those guys, and I just love them to death. And I like the Weirdos a lot. I like the Screamers a lot. I like Devo. And then when I moved to San Francisco, I liked the Sleepers. I liked Negative Trend.
Oh, yeah, Negative Trend was good.
Yeah, the Nuns.
What about the Avengers? I love the Avengers.
I love the Avengers, too. Yeah, Greg was an amazing guitar player. I was always just like, whoa, that guy's fucking good. And Danny was great on drums, too, also. Anyway, so I don't know. There were a lot of good bands, man.
Yeah. I saw Penelope about maybe, I was going to say a year ago, but kind of, because of the pandemic, it might have been a year and a half or 2 years ago. That's not from early or exact onset Alzheimer's. It's because of the suspended animation of the pandemic, but she looked great and we hung out a little bit. Yeah, it was good.
Before we went into the Twilight Zone.
Yes, exactly. But so tell me what you did in the Twilight Zone. Like, what were you doing during all the pandemic horror?
Well, I was right here. I was sitting right here and I was recording. You know, ever since I was a kid, you know, like before the Zeros, like before the Main Street Brats, I started writing songs and I, you know, would record cassettes and sort of make an album, you know, and stuff like that. And so, you know, that's like my main thing that I love to do. And so I've been sitting here recording songs, and now I have, you know, now you can do it on your computer and you just need a microphone and plug your guitar in, and there's already drums on there that you could click on and blah, blah, blah. So I recorded tons of songs that I'm making my third solo record. So I was working on that. And then I want to do another Zeros album. So I was working on that. And then I would say, oh, maybe I need an acoustic record, you know. So I've just been going crazy in the studio, basically, but I love it.
That's cool. I mean, that's good, you know, if if you're doing something that you like that you can do, not, you know, not in public, then it was a good pandemic. I had that too. Like I wrote a book and then, you know, I just was.
How many books do you have out?
I have 8 books out. And then when this one comes out, will be the 9th one. It's it got a little bit postponed though, because I had to get a surgery. But right before I had to get a surgery, my publisher, Iris Berry, who was also active in the she slipped and like literally broke her elbow. So she had a bunch of pins in her arm. And that, you know, that happened when she was about to start Jack Grisham's book. And then everything got a little bit held up, but it'll be fine. You know, it'll come out soon. But that was a good pandemic. That was kind of like me going in the studio.
you took care of it and it's done now. Huh? That's good. Well, not to be left out, I had some major health stuff happen and a little while ago, but I'm back, so it's cool.
No, that's good. What, did you have COVID or something else?
No, it was kind of like it was surgery, but you know, I don't really want to go into it. But
no, you don't have to go into it.
Everything. You know, everything worked out fine in the end, and I feel way better than I felt before, and so everything's good. But, you know, it just comes with the territory.
Yeah, I mean, of our age, or just...
Yeah, well, yeah.
I don't feel like I'm 62. How old are you?
I'm 63.
Do you feel like you... I mean, I only feel like it when I wake up in the morning. I mean, when I creak into action in the morning.
Yeah, I don't really feel it. I mean, I don't know. It comes and goes. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Depends on what I'm trying to do, I guess.
Yeah, okay. Let's have another little break, and then we will come right back.
Okay.
Okay, Javier is back, and so are we. So, tell me about the don't only tell me, tell everyone out in podcast land about your other two solo records, and then when you think that this one's going to come out, or what the concept or idea of it or title is or anything.
Okay. Well. It's kind of funny, you know, the Nerves got us our first show, the Zeros first show. And I tried to write songs with Peter Case one time, and we just had a blast. You know, it was great. We just talked about everything, and we didn't get any music. I mean, we wrote some songs and stuff, but what I think he doesn't need me, and I sort of don't need him in a way. Like, I guess we write our songs by ourselves anyway, so we kind of, but it was a blast to hang out with him anyway. So he goes, you got a solo album out? And I was like, no, you know. So I went home and I was like, well, I don't have a solo album. It never occurred to me. I don't know why. So I started working on it. The first demos I did were with Tony Kinman and Ryan Adams and Denny Sidewell from Wings, you know, and it was weird because I got sober in 2000 and that's when I started recording. And so I kind of didn't have my land legs, and the guy who was running the studio made all these technical mistakes. Anyway, so I didn't put that session out. I still have it. And then I kept recording and recording and recording. And I had done a tour of Scandinavia with a band called Chariot, which was, you know, Bill Bartell from Pat Fear from White Flag.
Yeah.
So he would, you know, like when the Zeros did that reunion show at the Palace and the Go-Go's played and X played, I think, and all these bands played, it was a benefit for Craig Lee.
Right.
You remember that?
Yeah.
Well,
Craig Lee from the Bags for you guys.
Right, Craig Lee from the
Bags. The original Bags, and then he was a really great music journalist too.
Yeah, he wrote for the LA Weekly. But so after that show, this kid comes up to me and goes like, "Oh man, you got to record a single for my label, you know." And it was Bill Bartell. You know, I don't know if you met him. I'm sure you did.
Yeah.
Pat Fear from White Flag. And he was this crazy kid. I mean, he was younger than me, but not that much younger. But anyway, so we decided to do a single. Like, we hadn't really thought about playing. So anyway, we did a single for him. And then I just started recording more and more. And I got involved with a Spanish label. So that's what I did my first solo record on. And meanwhile, back and forth recording Zeros records. And then the last solo record, the first one's called City Lights and it's on Folk Records, F-O-L-K. And the other one is called Kicked Out of Eden. And that's on, Sostex Records from—
Oh yeah, Sostex.
Yeah, from Texas.
Yeah.
And I'm recording a new one. And I recorded too many songs and, you know, I'm almost done with it, but it's taken me forever, but it's what I love to do anyway. So it's cool.
Do you know who's going to put that out or not? Or you don't know yet?
No, I don't. I don't know who's going to put it out, but I have a manager now, Mike Weber. And he's from Kansas City, and I met him way back in the 80s in the True Believers. And he's actually responsible for the Zeros documentary because he talked to his friend, Anthony Ladeish. And so he's the director. And so he got the whole ball rolling. So hopefully, we'll get that record out, but we got to get the documentary out and then another Zeros album. So it might be a while.
Yeah, I'm excited for the documentary. What are you guys calling it? Do you know?
It's called Beat Your Heart Out.
Okay. I was going to say that, but then I thought maybe I was just imagining it.
No. Yeah.
That's good.
Anthony chose the title and I don't care what it's called, as long as it's coming out. I'm really excited about it. I'm really happy about it. And I don't know, it's a crazy, great feeling.
Who else is in it besides getting interviewed, besides me? No.
Let me see if I can remember. We've interviewed a lot of people. The McDonald brothers from Red Cross.
Awesome.
Filmed theirs the other day. Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo. Ronnie from the Muffs. Danny DeGorio from the Offs and the True Believers. Peter Urban. Peter Urban, who was our manager in San Francisco, Chip Kinman, and a bunch of people I can't think of.
Cool. Well, but, that's an amazing start right there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really been a wild thing, you know. It just kind of snowballed, you know, and it's more and more, it's becoming more exciting and more interesting as we go along. We also interviewed, like, you know, Robert's dad and my wife, Rhoda, and Baba's dad. And so it has this family element in it also, which is really cool also, you know. It's pretty interesting, actually, you know.
I think it's great. Like, I know obviously you're so close to it, but any kind of documentary about that time period, if it's done by people that are, you know, quote, quote, sensitive to what was going on then, it's amazing, because so many people are obsessed with punk rock. And when you stop and think about it, like, right now at this point of time, we are farther away from punk rock than when we were little, it was till like the 20s, you know, like the 1920s. Wow. Isn't that mind-boggling?
Oh my God.
No, I know. It's like, it's so crazy.
I know. But, you know, we were in the right place at the right time, you know?
Exactly. I remember my mom used to think it was, quote, quote, a phase. And I used to tell her, no, I think this is like Paris in the 20s, or like the Beats in North Beach or the East Village scene. This is not a thing. It's a, you know, it's kind of like a cultural revolution. And then she would kind of roll her eyes at me, but I had read enough at that point, even as a teenager, to know that this wasn't just like it wasn't a fad, and it definitely wasn't a manufactured fad. It was really like a huge change of something, you know. And I think also, whether people sensed that or not back in the day, that's why everyone was so excited about it, you know, because it wasn't just the fact that mainstream radio was boring. This was like a whole different thing. It was like people not conforming to any kind of standard of regular mm-hmm. everyday life that was going on in the 70s, you know, like.
Yeah. Well, it was like all the outcasts, you know, all the outcast weirdos, people who thought really differently, all of a sudden had a place to go and meet and talk and, you know, do their art and, you know, get in bands, make flyers, whatever, you know. And I think that was the thing that was exciting for me, because like, I didn't know anybody who liked the Velvet Underground, you know what I mean?
Right. Or like, or you know? Yeah, or like, you know, who read the same books as you did, yeah, or as I did, or saw the same movies. I mean, there was like a huge, like, giant frame of reference that so many people in the early punk scene had, that was so outre at the time, that like it was mm-hmm. mind blowing to meet people that like knew who musicians or authors or filmmakers were and had the same taste as you. It was just, because that was hard to find in those days when there wasn't social media and that shit wasn't on mainstream television or in the news or anything, you know? I mean,
yeah, I think that's why it was probably so exciting for us as teenagers, you know, because then there was a place for us to be, you know, and there was this awkward period, I call it, in between glitter and punk rock, you know, that kind of like nobody knew what to do in a way. Nobody knew what was going to happen, you know. And then, you know, like Patti Smith, I guess, came out. I don't know what the timeline was, but you could feel it almost happening, and then it did, you know. It was cool.
Yeah, I always call that like the fuzzy gray area between glitter and punk, because my concept is that like anyone that was into glitter, that camp pretty quickly spread into two factions, the people that went for the disco because they were there for glitter, for the dancing, and then the people that were there for the weirdness and the craziness and the artiness went to punk, you know?
That's funny. What do you think about, like, I was thinking the other day that, like, if you were a certain age, you were like a hippie, mm-hmm. and if you were a certain age, you were total punk.
Well,
you think so?
I think kind of, but I mean, I grew up on a college campus in the 60s, like at Wesleyan. And so like I was indoctrinated into hippie stuff, but it was also like hippie in that campus where I was growing up, hippies were the uh-huh. same as like the women's movement and the Black Panthers. And I had Black Panther babysitters and people that were like just arty weirdos. So even though people were wearing like love beads or sometimes like wandering around like in a loincloth or something on campus, like I got thrown out of, well, not thrown out, but sent home from fourth grade because I was wearing a strike armband on one arm and a war moratorium armband on the other arm. And I didn't want to take it off. So my mother had to come and pick me up at school. And also, my very first concert that wasn't Alice Cooper, the one that I chose to go to, was seeing the Grateful Dead on the mm-hmm. campus of Wesleyan University with the Merry Pranksters there and like a ring around the rosy circle of like probably 300 people like dancing around, like holding hands and dancing around the whole concert area. So
that's wild.
I was kind of in, you know, as a little kid in the hippie era, but because most of my babysitters were Black men and they were dating like white women, and this is in a Catholic town in Connecticut, like, you know, it was very political and very like shocking to grownups, you know, but it seemed totally normal to me. But I do remember, all the punks, or maybe not all the punks, but a lot of punks, self included, whenever we wanted to get good acid, we'd always go to a Grateful Dead show and go to the parking lot and get it instead of getting it from like Jack in the Box on Hollywood Boulevard.
That's hilarious.
Yeah,
because
what?
You know what? I've never taken LSD.
Wow. Well, apparently you didn't need to. No, I'm just kidding.
Totally. Totally.
I can't take it anymore, but sometimes I have like like LSD. I mean, I'm not sober, but I'm like, you know, I drink like quarterly maybe, you know, but I stopped taking it like ages and ages ago. I don't even remember when the last time I did any kind of psychedelics, just because it was taking my body a long time to recover. And you know, I've been a professional dancer for 30 years. And I was like, I can't like not, you know, I can't have a hangover, or I can't like have a day or two of being quiet after taking shit tons of acid. So it was a practical decision.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But that hippie and punk element is kind of true. But then, like we were saying, there was such a non-homogeneous punk scene in the early days anyway, that like no matter what anyone was doing, it kind of fit. But do you remember when people used to be somewhere like at the Whiskey or the Starwood, there'd be like someone like the Damned or I don't know, the Dickies or someone playing, and there'd always be like someone or a couple of people in tie-dye in the back just doing interpretive dancing right now.
Yeah. Well, do you remember some of the first bands that played like the New Wave Nights? Were totally like, they had long hair.
Oh yeah, they were appalling. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was really funny because it was so awkward.
Yeah. You know? Well, I don't know if they probably felt the awkwardness, because I remember us giving them like the stink eye.
But it was kind of funny that the first few months, you know, maybe the first 6 months, I don't know, were like, I guess, you know, there really wasn't that many bands, you know, so they like, you know, Kim Fowley and Rodney Bingenheimer's New Wave Nights.
Yeah.
And they had some kind of like hippie bands playing. I just thought it was so weird.
No, but because they didn't quite get it. I mean, it was weird because they were both such tastemakers in music. They knew good music, but I think just like they didn't, I think they might have also been afraid to get bands that were openly calling themselves punk bands, like the Germs or the Weirdos, because like a lot of the club owners were afraid that, you know, like the toilets were going to get trashed or there'd be like a bunch of like mayonnaise and peanut butter on the stage or something.
Yeah, I wonder why that's weird. I wonder where they got that from.
Well, anything else you want to talk about before we conclude this episode?
No.
No.
I don't know.
Well, I can't wait to rave about you in the Zeros documentary. And for you guys listening, we don't know exactly when it's coming out, but I can tell you this is going to be great. This is going to be like the real Zero story from their own mouths and from the mouths of anyone that, you know, was around them and loved them back in the day and still. So I know you all.
Oh, yeah.
But go ahead.
I would like to say that the Zeros are going to play Punk Rock Bowling.
And what, in September in Las Vegas?
Yeah, in Las Vegas. And we're going to play the Thursday. And Rat Scabies is playing that night. And I don't know, check it out. I don't know what other bands are playing.
And say the venue in Las Vegas.
The venue. I don't even know, but okay, you can find it.
It's fucking Punk Rock Bowling.
But it's the Thursday before, so
I think I'm
always
gonna
play
go to
it. Thursday. Oh, cool! Awesome. Let me know.
I will let you know for sure. Cool. And everyone else, check out Punk Rock Bowling. And if you haven't, wait. Why was I just rubbing the microphone? I hope nobody in podcast land could hear that. Anyway, on that note, Javier makes me rub the microphone. No.
Oh, you know what I wanted to tell you?
What?
You know, you wrote some liner notes. Was it the Rhino compilation?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. And you said something about me being a heartthrob, but I love that you said whether he knew it or not.
Oh.
Because that was the crucial part for me, because I was totally my own world and wasn't thinking about girls really.
Oh, that's cool. Well, I mean, now you know, or you know when that came out.
Yeah. So thank you.
You're welcome. Oh, maybe that's why I was rubbing the microphone, baby. Oh, yeah. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what reminded me. No, I'm just kidding. All right. Talk to you later.
Okay, you guys. Talk to you later, Javier. That was the amazing Javier Escovedo. And he is just fabulous. Wasn't that great? I hope you enjoyed listening to him and listening to all his amazing songs, and look for more music coming out and the Zeros documentary, Beat Your Heart Out, even if you don't know if people are beating for you.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye. It was so great to talk to you.
With the yank of your hair, I got this feeling that you.
The Devil's Music is written and hosted by Pleasant Gaiman. Produced by Aaron Alden. All sound design by Jerry Danielson of Busy Signal Studios. And of course, is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at pantheonpodcasts.com. Our social presence is at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us at Pantheon Pods. All songs can be found wherever you get great music. Please pick up these important and fantastic tracks. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.